Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. And this is the granddaddy of all Health Matters shows. This is celebrating and personally honoring
a granddaddy.
A grandchild, Adelaide Marie Schutte.
But you did call it the granddaddy of all shows. So it's not really about the grandbaby. It's about the granddaddy.
You cannot have a granddaddy without a grandbaby. I have been to the
mountaintop.
I've been to Georgia to visit my firstborn grandchild, Adelaide Marie Schutte, and she is a wonderful baby. We asked the press to please respect our privacy.
Right.
Yeah, so don't, the paparazzi, don't post pictures of Adelaide.
Did your daughter come out on the balcony so that they could take pictures?
And dangle her by one foot?
No, that was Michael Jackson. I mean, I'm thinking more of the royal treatment.
Yeah, Noah actually did not. The baby was named pretty much as soon as the baby was born. Let me ask you something, Rick. We said we wouldn't talk about Kate. We said we wouldn't, but...
We said that as on the show?
Well, I'm just...
Kate who?
Before Princess Duchess of Windsor, whatever, I don't know.
I stopped when if they have more than three names in their title,
yeah,
I'm done.
Yeah, so forget it. But here's the thing. You're pregnant for 9 months. Don't you think you have thought about baby names?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, Dana Carvey named his son Dex because that was what's on the IV bag. It was dextrose in the IV. So there are those spur-of-the-moment things, but honestly...
Well, now, he does strike me as a guy who probably doesn't...
Does not think deeply, but honestly, yeah. If you are a royal person and you've had a chance to inspect the line of kings and queens dating back to medieval times, don't you think you know what you're going to name?
But let's be honest, did they really have a choice in the name? I mean, isn't there some kind of a hierarchy that they have to follow?
So you think that they was forced on them and they fought?
Well, I think the Philip obviously comes from somewhere, and the George probably, who knows, probably King George, who knows?
Yeah.
All that stuff probably was, they probably had to pick from six of them. They only got to choose the order, not the names.
Well, Adelaide is a town in Australia where my daughter spent some time as a college student. And Marie is in honor of Marie Curie, inspiration to all women scientists. Of course, she.
Well, I thought it was after my daughter, Casey Marie.
Oh. I didn't know you had a Marie.
Yeah,
that's
Casey
okay.
Marie.
Yeah. You know, usually you do the French names if you're going to enter your child in the Miss Tiny Tot contest. So I think Adelaide is still a possibility for the Miss Tiny Tot contest. You need that Tiffany.
When are they going to go ahead and crown the Junior Miss title for that grandbaby?
My kids have been active in Junior Miss. That is correct. That's why we named the show what we named the show.
Okay, granddaddy.
Yeah, and my co-medical host here, a man who never
listens
to... I'll leave it at that. That sounds good. The man who never listens to anything I say from the University of Kentucky, service owner for telephony, Rick Phillips, to talk about the web presence of Health Matters on the interweb.
Well, Tony, you know, you can get the audio of the shows, and for all of you who think you know what I'm about to say, you're wrong. You don't go to msuradio.com anymore. You go to wmky.org. We have changed.
And it's pretty nice. You get the newsletters. Now you can see those right there
absolutely.
In the show listing.
Well, you know, hey, every once in a while you just need a facelift, right, Tony? Isn't that what you need?
I didn't think you would say that. Well, thank you very much. Yes, it is true. There's a certain age beyond which you shouldn't trust what nature gave you.
Well, when it comes to websites, they need facelifts every once in a while. Hey, guess what? Come out, look at WMKY.org. There you will find a brand new, it's still got that new website smell. Just scratch your screen, you'll smell it. It's amazing. WMKY.org. You can still get the audio of the shows. They're still there in MP3 format. I will admit there's a little more information about each show. There's a narrative, a little brief about what's going to be in, you know, or what you might expect in the show. It's all right there. Again, WMKY.org. And then after you've gone there, you want to keep surfing, go over to Facebook.com, put a /HM Radio Show on the end, or do a search for HM Radio Show, and you will find a page devoted to Health Matters. And once again, more information about Health Matters. It's more research, more comments, more of you, less of us. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Sure.
And it's right there at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
And we've been thinking, you know.
Really?
I proposed this. No, not much, really. But we pretend like we're thinking.
See, aren't you glad I was listening?
I proposed this to Rick before the show. You know, we need, I think,
something. Proposed?
if it doesn't go viral, it needs to at least go bacterial or fungal.
Well, that would be appropriate.
Would kind of explode onto the blogosphere and so forth. And I've been looking. Of course, my name is Anthony Weaver, and that immediately makes you think of
Granddaddy.
Anthony Weiner.
Well, yeah.
New York mayoral candidate and congressman who has a way with internet. I mean, he is lighting up the internet. And apparently what you do, first you take some racy photos of yourself, and then you need a really good name to post under. And so he went with Carlos Danger.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a great name. I would certainly go see Carlos Danger movies.
He could have had a better... I mean, Carlos is good, but he could have probably put something in front of Danger that, you know...
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I'm thinking I need a name like that to really set off Health Matters, and I'm just going to try this out. Just going to throw this out, Rick. Just throw it out, see what you think. Haphazard. What do you think? I mean, you know, it's a cowboy.
If that doesn't describe this show, I don't know what does. 500 times we've approached this thing haphazardly.
So that is our web presence, our sponsor for today's show. West Nile Virus, reminding you, West Nile is not just a riverbank in Egypt. Now, a brief history for this fractional portion of the West Nile Virus. It was the last major emerging infection in the 20th century. Right there, 1999, we realized we have a problem with West Nile Virus. It is mosquito transmitted. It was new to the Western Hemisphere, appeared in New York City, late summer of 1999. Infected crows were literally dropping from the sky. Do you remember when it came through the first time? I remember there was a hawk standing in the middle of the road out in front of our farm.
I don't remember that because I wasn't there.
But the fact was that it had a major effect on particularly birds of prey. It then spread from those birds to humans through the mosquitoes. And one of the problems had been that we had gotten somewhat complacent regarding mosquito control. We said, okay, this yellow fever, we're taking care of that. We don't really have any major mosquito-borne illnesses, and we have to use those pesticides, so we're not going to spray anymore. And the New York City vector control program really was not very effective in clearing West Nile virus. It spread throughout the country, currently affects all contiguous 48 states. I have reported cases of West Nile virus. And it was reviewed in the AMA Journal in July of 2013. We've got, for our second fractional portion, the top 10 facts you need to know about West Nile virus, and we'll pick that up our next fractional portion. Now, this experiment, Rick, this first article, was tailor-made for you. If we cannot talk about this, we should go home right now.
Okay.
This is from Auden Dahl, who's at the University of California in Berkeley. And the question was, and again, we're talking about babies and grandbabies.
Right.
Fear of heights. I think all of us as parents have had a situation where a baby just inexplicably just crawls off a table, a desk, just puts themselves at risk of serious injury because they have no fear of heights.
Absolutely. Well, is it fear or knowledge?
They think fear, and we'll get into that. But they do, obviously, they acquire that. They get to the point where they want. And so how do they acquire that? That was the question that the guys in Berkeley wanted to know. They said 6 weeks or so after babies learn to crawl, they become scared of heights. So what they did, they said, okay, maybe it's the crawling. They took babies who could not yet crawl.
We're doing research on crawling babies.
On non-crawling babies. They put the babies into go-karts that they could control with joysticks. Now, I want to give our
You're serious. Now, you're telling me you're not making any of this up.
I am not. You could.
What they do, put a little padded helmet on them?
I don't know. I really don't know.
A go-kart?
I can see, and I'm sure it wasn't going that fast. I mean, a go-kart's a nice term. These babies were not whizzing around a track at 30 miles an hour.
But that's the first thing you go to when you say go-kart.
Yeah, but at any rate, what they said, this came from New Scientist, which is one of my favorite journals. It's a British journal, and they discussed some of the stranger scientific research. So they put the babies who couldn't crawl into go-karts. They raced them around. They ran them around the room. They motored them around the room. And for 3 weeks, the babies would come in and have their go-kart session. The other babies, control group, couldn't crawl, just sat there.
Right.
Okay. Then they lowered them toward about a drop-off. It was about a little bit over a yard and a half or so tall.
Please tell me it was padded.
They didn't drop them. They just lowered them. And the heart rates of the baby go-karters increased by about 5 beats a minute, while the sitting babies had no increase at all, suggesting that the go-kart babies were afraid of heights, whereas the sitting still babies weren't.
You don't think the thrill seekers had a naturally higher heart rate?
Well, there are so many things about this. The idea is you get your fear of heights from your peripheral vision. So once you start moving and things start moving around you, you become unsettled, and that gives you your fear of heights. As long as you are not moving, that's not a problem. Now, I have all kinds of problems with this research scientifically because I remember very much taking my first child in my arms and racing her up and down the grocery store shelves and watching her eyes flicker. And so there was a lot of movement before she learned to crawl.
Right.
I'm not willing to accept that part. But the other part of me wonders, how in the world you
did
go
you
to a parent,
run up and down the aisles?
I went really fast so she could see the colors of all the products. You know, it was red and blue and all that.
And which
really
one of
cool.
these? Was this both your all this three?
I remember it specifically with Virginia, my oldest. But
okay.
Yeah, but it's a lot of fun. You know, you spin around in a chair. You move back and forth. You put them in the high chair. Babies are in all kinds of motion. Maybe not
well,
go-kart
aren't
motion.
Most of their toys like the chairs and the bouncy things and the swings? And
yeah.
The, I mean, how many babies get in a swing to get put to sleep?
But these hadn't crawled, so this was very young babies. But I'm saying even in their parents' arms, you know, babies get a lot of motion.
Of course.
And so I'm not really buying this. But the other part of it that really fascinated me is how in the world do you go to a parent and say, I'd like to put your baby in a go-kart?
Yeah.
Again, do I have permission? And I've got a joystick. I'll control the go-kart. And you go, well, how many other go-karts are on the track? You know,
how much money are you going to give them?
Yeah, are these bumper cars or go-karts? Are these babies going to, you know, I don't know. I thought it was a strange thing. Then they had the babies crawl to their mothers, and they crawled on a glass table. And the first part of the table had a solid base underneath it, and then the base dropped off, so they were crawling out on glass. And the babies that had been on the go-karts would not crawl across the open glass because they were afraid of the drop-off. The other babies would. So I think this is very strange research, I got to say. I'm not sure I agree with it because I think of all the motions my baby went through, but I am really intrigued. Wouldn't you love to see a room full of babies in go-karts? Non-crawling babies, newborn babies in go-karts.
I mean, the whole idea, it's just comical to think about. Yeah, as a parent, I can't even imagine enrolling my children in that kind of research.
I got a clue because you can hear one of the babies that was crawling across the glass table got scared at the edge where the things dropped off, and so the baby just crawled off to the side and stood up. And you can hear the mom yelling at the baby, that's just great, Michael. We're trying to do research on crawling here, and now you're climbing on the side. And so I think that kind of mom is the one who would put her baby in a go-kart for science, especially at Berkeley. I mean, you know, you go to Berkeley, that's very prestigious. If any baby is going to get in a go-kart, it'll be mine.
You're losing me.
I'm just saying this is a mom that wants the kid to go to Berkeley when the kid's six.
I think we should put the mom in the go-kart. Check her fear of heights.
and drive the go-kart off the cliff. I don't
or
know.
A roller coaster.
Yeah, there's several. Oh, man, that brings up a whole new thing. But we don't have time for a whole new thing because we've got to go to break. So why don't you call your grandbabies and say hi to them and smother your kids with affection. You've got a few minutes to do that. We'll be back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weber. This is the granddaddy of all Health Matters shows. Salute again to Adelaide Marie Schutte, my first grandchild, my only grandchild so far, a beautiful young bouncing baby girl in Athens, Georgia.
How big?
She was a couple ounces shy of 10 pounds.
Wow.
So she was
keeper.
A big baby.
That's
yeah.
a keeper.
That is a keeper. Yeah, you would not throw that one back by any stretch.
I can't believe that I'm doing the 503rd show or second show, whatever it is, with Grandpa Weaver.
Yeah, one thing that
Grandpa Weaver.
I thought I would feel old. I don't particularly feel old. That's
not yet.
None of the emotions I have says I'm old because I'm now officially a grandpa. You know, when you hit 50, you think you're old. When you throw your back out, you're sure you're old. But having a grandchild.
Well, shoot, that one for me, that was in 30.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this. What memories do you have of your grandpa?
My grandpa, I grew up on a farm, on a cattle farm, and he helped my dad with fencing. He had two things that were really neat about him. One is he had a general store, and when we would go visit, he would let us eat anything in the store. He just opened the store up, and we would sit there, and we would eat ourselves.
So
silly.
Would you have literally like the chocolate rings around your mouth?
It was like Halloween every time we went to visit him. So he obviously
Cokes,
was my favorite granddad.
8-ounce Cokes, probably.
Yeah. My other granddad worked for the railroad. He was mail delivery for railroad, and he rode around a lot, gone some, and a nice guy, but he didn't have his own store. He didn't give me candy all the time.
So how does it make you feel that now in about 5 or 6 or 7 years, there's going to be a little tyke that's going to think that way about you?
Yeah, I got to figure out how I can bribe a kid.
Well, you guys will say free medical care isn't going to do it, man.
No, it's not. I need candy.
You're going to need to buy a candy store quick.
That's right.
Or a bakery.
Yeah, we got to do that. At least bring a candy bag down with us. Our sponsor for today's show.
Granddaddy Weaver.
West Nile virus. West Nile is not just a riverbank in Egypt. West Nile virus. These are our 10 fun facts according to a review article in the AMA Journal, July 2013. I'll give you the first five. Number one, West Nile virus is maintained in a bird-mosquito-bird transmission cycle. Mosquito bites account for nearly all human infections. It can be transmitted through a blood transfusion or organ transplants, but that is fairly rare. Well, organ transplants are fairly rare anyway. And the virus can stay in the organ donor even if it's not in the bloodstream. So we can't always test a blood test for West Nile virus in transplanted organs. It can still infect the recipient even if the blood test for West Nile virus is negative in the donor. Fun fact number two, since its introduction in North America in 1999, the virus has produced the three largest arboviral neuroinvasive disease outbreaks ever recorded in the United States. This has infected a lot of people. Arbo is arthropod-borne, and insects are apparently an arthropod, and that's why it's called an arbovirus. Fun fact number three, West Nile virus now endemic throughout the United States, the 48 contiguous states, with more than 780,000 illnesses, 16,000 neuroinvasive. That's when it gets serious. It invades the brain tissue. And 1,500 deaths since 1999. Fun fact number four, incidence is highest in the Midwest from mid-July to early September. So we are in the middle of the high season for West Nile virus. 94% of people with West Nile virus infection have symptoms July through September. Fun fact number five, West Nile fever develops in a quarter of those infected. It varies greatly in clinical severity, and the symptoms may be prolonged. It may take a while to clear. More than 50% of patients have headaches, generalized weakness, and a rash, and also muscle aches. Less common symptoms, joint pain, chills, painful eyes. That's awful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Vomiting or diarrhea and lymphadenopathy. That's our first five fun facts from our top 10 fun facts about West Nile virus. This is a disease you need to be aware of, and it makes mosquito control and mosquito avoidance much more important. It's not simply a bite that itches. This could transmit this disease, and we have had some very serious outbreaks of West Nile virus in the United States. Dallas last year, a major outbreak.
Well, Tony, over the last 5 or 6 years, I mean, this is something that we've talked about several times on Health Matters, and it's been a significant issue, and even to the point of making our year-end review on a few years. I mean, this was nothing to not take serious.
Yeah. Again, we sort of got lazy about mosquito control. I don't know. We'll wear a fogger. We're one of those silly sound-making machines that makes the sounds that the mosquitoes can't stand, something like that, or we'll burn a candle. But the truth of the matter is we've got to control mosquitoes, especially in times of epidemics, because if a certain percent of mosquitoes have West Nile virus in them, we're going to see an outbreak in the human population.
Right.
It's just that it's a fact. Rick, I want to talk this fractional portion about a very, very influential, and actually next fractional portion as well, a very influential conference. This was the...
Well, you know what, Tony? It's your show. You're allowed to talk about it.
Thank you. And my daughter appreciated it. And grandparents everywhere will appreciate this. This was the Alzheimer's Association International Conference. It was in Boston. It was mid-July. If you've been thinking about what the press has been releasing, there have been a spate of very interesting, very practice-changing articles and announcements about Alzheimer's disease. And so I thought, let's just review what happened at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Boston in July. The first one was an article that was actually published July 16th in The Lancet, which is a British journal of medicine, from the University of Cambridge, indicating that the prevalence of dementia may be falling. They looked at the UK cognitive, UK meaning United Kingdom, cognitive function and aging study. The first one was in 1990 to 1993. They did a interview of a population ages 65 and older and determined which one of those, based on the interview, seemed to have cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's disease. Then they did the same thing 20 years later in 2008. Got over 7,000 people interviewed in each time, and they found a substantial decrease in the prevalence of dementia, dropped by around 30%. Now, the neat thing about it is this has nothing to do with whether doctors are diagnosing it or not, because they had an interview, and they had their own criteria for determining whether these people were demented or not.
Right.
And these older people had lower rates of dementia than they did before. Now, maybe then our declining rates of heart disease, our attention to our health, the fact that more people are college educated, all those things may be driving down dementia rates. But if they drop by a third, that's going to change a lot of the calculations of how much health care we're going to need in the U.S.
Well, sure.
Now, people dispute their methodology. Some people say it doesn't apply to the U.S. There certainly are some concerns, especially in a state like Kentucky, where we don't have as many college-educated people. We don't have the overall attention to general health that we should. We may not get the benefits that they have found in the United Kingdom. But by the same token, it certainly gives us at least a glimmer of hope that we're not all going to go bankrupt taking care of senior citizens with Alzheimer's.
Yeah, it does sound that way. I mean, it'd be interesting to know if in the study they did actually try to look at any kind of indicators or factors over the course of the 20 years other than just time.
Right. This is a very simple study, two sets of interviews 20 years apart and the results. And so they can speculate about
right.
what might have caused it.
But, hypothesize.
Right. But the data's pretty strong, at least from Great Britain.
So do you think there'll be follow-up research that tries to narrow down why that may have happened? Or, I mean, is this too broad or too vague?
No, I think we have to. As a matter of health policy, we're going to have to repeat this in the U.S. and confirm what they're seeing.
But now, does repeating it mean 20 years?
I think we will try to get as close as we can using, I expect to see this coming out of the Women's Health Initiative, out of that health professional follow-up study. Some of the things that we've reported, the big databases we have here in the U.S., we're going to try to see if we can replicate this. Because if our dementia, if our Alzheimer's disease rates are falling by a third, that will have a major impact on our health policy, on where we put our resources in the next 20 years.
So this would be a change per capita, not necessarily we just have less overall patients.
Right. Our concern was, again, with the baby boomers aging, a lot of things are going to become more prevalent, the diseases of older people.
Right.
And we had figured that the Alzheimer rate, I believe, is either doubled or tripled. It's going to be substantial. There are going to be a lot of money spent on Alzheimer's disease in the future if our former projections held up. If we could drop a third off the increased rates, we could really recapture a lot of funds and devote them to something else if we don't have to worry about that. So it's going to be important to repeat it first. And then, as you said, Rick, we're going to look at causes. And let me just say, this is one of the things that came out of Massachusetts, out of Boston, out of this international conference. Second article. This was from Christine Yaffe, who's at the University of California, San Francisco, and presented there. African Americans who are older are twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's disease as their white peers. Now, the question obviously is that genetic? Is that economic? What is driving that? So they looked at the dementia risk among 3,000 black people and 3,000 white people ages 70 to 79 years old at baseline, and they followed them for 12 years. They had about 19% of them develop dementia, and the African Americans, just like we have previously speculated, they were actually 22% versus 16%. They were more likely to develop dementia than
Caucasians. But that's still only 6%. That's
right.
Not
twice as likely. Here's the thing, though. When they actually looked at socioeconomic factors, the education level, literacy, income, and financial adequacy, they found there was no difference between senior citizen African Americans and senior citizens who were white in their rates of dementia. That is, it appears, if a person has a high level of education, literacy, they have a decent income, and they're financially stable, regardless of their race, they will have about the same risk of developing a dementia.
Hmm.
So this has a bearing on the ability of the brain to withstand the onslaught of Alzheimer's disease, education, and socioeconomic status, and it cannot be ignored. If we want to lower our rates of Alzheimer's disease and not have to pay for the care of people with Alzheimer's disease, if we're going to prevent it, one of the things we have to look at is the socioeconomic status of people as they get older.
Which is interesting because we've tied socioeconomic status to education, which ties to health care, which ties to insert situation here. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, the whole education and socioeconomic status, it's just amazing the differences it makes. I mean, you would think, Tony, that there would be something resilient about the human body that could deal with some of these things. But as it turns out, there are things that will definitely help you live a longer life.
Yeah, and we talk about poor but honest people, hardworking citizens, and so forth, but it comes down to education, income, and income stability. That over and over again, that's very clear. Now, if you do not have a great financial stability, obviously it is important to get as much education as you can. And we'll talk a little bit later on this fractional portion, keep your brain active throughout life, not simply sit on your college degree for the next 50 years.
Right.
But it is an important thing. Moving on, I mean, I'll let our radio fans think about that, but I want to throw some of this other stuff out because it's absolutely fascinating. This was from the July 15th USA Today, reporting on yet another presentation at the Alzheimer's Conference. They looked at military veterans, 3.5 million military veterans, and they found a relationship between Alzheimer's disease and cancer. That is, having cancer, and Rick, you know, we've talked about this before, having cancer lowers your rate of Alzheimer's disease. Having Alzheimer's disease lowers your rate of cancer. More than 82,000 of those 3.5 million veterans developed Alzheimer's during the 5 years of this study. 24% had been diagnosed with cancer previously. If you look at the cancer survivors, having liver cancer drops your risk of Alzheimer's by 51%. Lung cancer drops it by 25%, leukemia by 13%, pancreatic cancer 44%, esophageal cancer 33%, kidney cancer 22%, and so on and so on. Most every type of cancer site, no matter where the cancer started, seems to lower your risk of Alzheimer's disease. The only ones they found no correlation, colorectal, bladder, stomach, genital, thyroid, and brain cancer. Brain cancer, not good for your risk of Alzheimer's disease, as you might imagine.
Right.
And further, if you had cancer and you underwent chemotherapy, that dropped your risk by an additional 20 to 45% over just having the cancer alone and maybe having it removed surgery. I am stunned by that. Yeah, I would not have thought chemotherapy would be protective.
Yeah, I mean, chemotherapy is obviously designed to attack the cancerous cells, but what else is it taking care of there?
Well, and they stress, there is certainly no, this does not mean that we should take chemotherapy drugs to prevent Alzheimer's, because they are very toxic. The problem is we do not have, and let's just say the risk right now, our rates of Alzheimer's disease are rising. The current drugs are very unsatisfactory. There is no concrete evidence that they affect concrete endpoints of the disease, or that they stop the progression, or that they reduce risk. They are mainly symptomatic treatments, which is unfortunate. So to learn these correlations, to try to understand, we talk about socioeconomic status, now we talk about cancer status and being treated with chemotherapy. All these things affect your risk of Alzheimer's disease, and we don't exactly know why. Maybe the cancer drugs reduce inflammation, they shut down your immune system. Maybe they prevent brain cells from dividing, and maybe that's a good thing as you get older, that your brain cells don't divide. There was originally a theory that maybe you either are a liver or a dyer, and if your cells die, they produce Alzheimer's disease, and if they live, they produce cancers. Really, a lot of theories in play here, and I have no idea what's the right answer. A couple of other studies I want to mention. First of all, metformin, which is an excellent diabetes drug, had a lower rate of diabetes. They actually had a 26% lower rate than other diabetes drugs of Alzheimer's disease. We know that about 26% of diabetic patients get Alzheimer's disease as they get older anyway, and this dropped your risk down to about normal for a non-diabetic, just taking that drug, metformin, as opposed to taking some of the other pills we give for diabetes. Pretty good. Another thing, which may hurt your feelings, Rick, I don't know, late retirement may help prevent dementia.
Looks like I'm going to be demented.
Yeah.
Will that single-handedly cause you a late retirement?
Well, I'm going to retire late. I just know I am. I got, as people say, I've got too much to do. I can't possibly get all done that I want to get done.
Yeah, but you'll never get started on what you really want to get done if you don't get done the other stuff.
Well, this grandbaby makes you think about retirement.
Oh, yeah, sure. I can imagine. The granddaddy of all decisions.
This came from the French government, and they actually have invested quite a bit of money in studying Alzheimer's disease and dementia in France. They looked at 500,000 people. This was the largest study to look at retirement and dementia. They have a very detailed national health records, and so they looked at 429,000 workers. Most of these were shopkeepers or craftsmen. They were bakers, woodworkers, things like that. Average age, 74. Average retirement, 12 years. They retired at 62 on the average. 3% had developed dementia, but the risk was lower for each year of age at retirement. If you retire at age 65, you had a 15% lower risk of developing dementia compared to retiring at 60. Now, you think to yourself, well, of course, the people who were developing Alzheimer's retired at 60 because they couldn't do their job anymore.
Right, right.
Well, they controlled for that. They said, all right, we're not going to look at anybody who developed dementia within 5 years of retirement. And then they went back and said, we won't look at anybody who developed dementia within 10 years of retirement, and they got the same results. That is, it may have been that those people knew something, but certainly their doctors did not know anything beyond what they knew about their mental abilities, because they were not diagnosed for up to 10 years afterwards. You still saw this benefit. So, and I know this sounds like government propaganda, but it does appear that working longer, apart from, they think it's probably brain stimulation. You just need to be on a regular basis stimulating your brain a little bit more than you do in retirement.
Well, sure. I mean, and why does that not just seem like good advice? I call it mental gymnastics. Doing mental gymnastics every day in my job, I mean, it certainly, it helps to keep you I don't know. I guess it gives you something to do. It gives you some way to keep. It's, again, I go back to gymnastics. It's training.
It is training. Now, there is this theory that, well, what you need to do is you work puzzles. You solve problems. You take
Candy
music
Crush
lessons.
Doesn't count.
fair enough. I think the other thing is at your job, you have deadlines to keep.
Sure.
And I don't think that getting up at 9:30 on a weekday morning and working a crossword puzzle in your bathrobe is the same as jumping out of bed, driving to work, and really taking on the world as you do as an actively employed person.
I'll sum it up this way. I have 3 phones in my house. I have 22,000 at work, and I'm responsible for the phones. So, I mean, yeah, I can't get the same mental gymnastics at home that I get at work.
Ask not for whom the phone rings. You know, Rick, it rings for you. but that type of job, I mean, that mental stress, there is something bad about it. Something you try to avoid it.
Well, sure.
But in fact, it appears to be good for you, just like eating your vegetables is good for you. Now, we've got a deadline. We've only got a few seconds here to close out this fractional portion and get to break. So we just want to remind you before we leave, you're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is a third and final fractional portion of the granddaddy of all shows. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, otherwise known as Hap Hazard, for my tweets and my internet posts.
Granddaddy Hap.
Yeah. That sounds good, doesn't it? That could happen.
Granddaddy Hap.
There you go. Our sponsor for the last time for today's show, West Nile Virus, reminding you West Nile is not just a riverbank in Egypt. West Nile virus, the mosquito-borne virus that can cause West Nile fever with muscle aches and generalized weakness, but also they have a neuroinvasive form of this that causes a meningitis and encephalitis and can make a person very seriously ill. So we were up to, fun fact number 6, neuroinvasive disease, the meningitis, encephalitis, and paralysis develops in less than 1% of cases but carries a fatality rate of 10%. 2/3 of those with paralysis remain with significant weakness in the affected limbs. And in that sense, it's like polio used to be. You know, for the rest of their lives, they will walk funny. They will
impacted.
Have weakness by that. Number 7, the diagnosis usually rests on detection of by a blood test or checking the spinal fluid to look for antibodies to this. Number 8, and this is disappointing, Rick. Even in this disease first hit the United States in 1999, so we are now basically
one of the few things before Health Matters started.
That's right. 14 years and counting, treatment is still supportive. There is no vaccine. It does not appear to respond significantly to antiviral medicines. Full recovery is the norm for people with uncomplicated West Nile fever or meningitis, but the extreme fatigue, the initial symptoms may be very prolonged. Fact number 9, prevention uses an integrated pest management approach, which means that we need to eliminate most mosquito breeding sites. That's the spare tires, the gutters, the places where water accumulates. And my goodness, has water accumulated at the Weaver place this year?
Tony, I mean, you know, part of that, does that really count at our... I have a pond. You have something that would be deemed slightly larger than a pond. But those are such large bodies of water relative to a old tire.
Right.
That wouldn't we suggest that getting rid, I mean, isn't that futile for us to try to get rid of old tires and water spots?
I think the thing is with the ponds is that bats fly over, frogs patrol the borders, dragonflies around. That is a natural habitat. The problem with the tire is the predators cannot get to the developing mosquitoes in, say, a gutter situation. And so I think we still should eliminate those small pools of standing water that are cut off from the environment where mosquitoes can breed and
free
can
of predator.
Yeah. So I think, you don't drain your pond. You don't dam up the rivers or anything like that. But if you have small pools of water on your place, as a matter of fact, we wash out the bird bath every couple of days, every 3 days, because you can see mosquito larvae in it. We just don't want them. And I'm certain they're there in the pond, but they're getting eaten up pretty fast because we don't have mosquito problems at our place. And fun fact number 10, during outbreaks, this is important, outbreaks or impending outbreaks, emphasis shifts to aggressive adult mosquito control. And many places in the South have reinstituted spraying for mosquitoes, particularly if we see a high percentage of mosquitoes carrying the West Nile virus. They're hoping to be able to shut that down. Now, we used to do this all the time. Mosquito control by spraying was very common. and we got away from it because we didn't think we needed it. This disease is serious enough and deadly enough that it's going to change mosquito control practices in some of our southern metropolitan areas.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, there's just, you're in a wet, warm, humid environment. You know, you throw in some of these things, it's just, we're just a great place for mosquitoes. Now, that's coming from a person who used to live in Louisiana where the state bird was the mosquito.
Right.
You know, they obviously have it worse down south where it's considerably more humid and considerably more wet. But that doesn't mean that we don't take it serious up here. And I would expect that places like Minnesota, and even though the weather's cold in the summer months, they're probably having mosquito issues.
Yeah, I would think so. And again, West Nile virus has been found everywhere in the contiguous United States. And the last major outbreak last year was in Texas, particularly around Dallas.
Doesn't it fascinate you just a little bit that something as small as a mosquito can carry a virus like this and still find its way through the entire lower 48 when you look at places like Arizona, New Mexico, Texas? You know, it's obviously traveling with humans or somehow or another. I mean, mosquitoes aren't flying across the desert.
No, they're not. And you're right. The disease, birds are. And
right.
The idea is probably human-to-human transmission is a really minor component. Again, we do it if we get blood transfusions or organ transplants. But actually, a mosquito biting one human and biting another, just like HIV/AIDS, that never happens.
Right.
But certainly, birds are an excellent vector. Apparently, their viral titers are higher, and if a mosquito somewhere else bites them, it can pick it up. The other thing is we're seeing a change, just like we saw a change in the tick population. We're seeing a change in the mosquito population. So some of the mosquitoes that carry some of these diseases are becoming more prevalent throughout the United States.
Right.
That is not a good thing, but we are seeing that as well.
It's fascinating how this thing can spread via birds and mosquitoes through some of the most desolate places in the world.
You know, and it's interesting, Greg, because I thought you were going to go in the other direction. I am amazed, first of all, that ticks are so nasty. There are so many diseases
right.
that are tick-borne. Mosquitoes are so nasty. And you look at horseflies, which I hate. Horseflies right. and deer flies are really annoying. And yet, as far as I know, they don't spread a darn thing.
Right. Well, they're big, and usually when they bite you, it stings because they, you know, it's I don't know.
I haven't figured it out because they fly around in horse manure and cow manure. You can't say, well, gee, that, you know, they're not particularly clean bugs or anything
right,
like that.
Right.
But they don't spread it, and other critters do. That's our sponsor, West Nile Virus, reminding you West Nile is not just a riverbank in Egypt. Now, I want to finish up. I'm going to keep going on this. But we were talking about retirement age and Alzheimer's disease. And again, the French research indicates that the longer you work, the lower your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And they tried to tease out those who would stop working because of Alzheimer's disease by not considering anybody who is diagnosed within 10 years of retiring. And the rates were still lower for people who worked longer.
Do we think that's a valid way to weed out those? I want to call them statistical anomalies, but, you know, statistical deviations. You know?
Right. I think the idea is if you stopped your job because you simply could not keep up with all those 22,000 phones, you should be diagnosed with some type of cognitive impairment within the next 10 years if you simply cannot do that. Now, you're right. Suppose you're functioning at a very high level and you drop down, you don't feel comfortable. You're a nuclear physicist, you're a techno guru,
sure.
and you drop down to ordinary intelligence. It may take you several years, but 10 years is a long time to be in a cognitive decline without it showing up clinically. I think it's a reasonable study. And I think the other thing.
But Tony, I'm not stopping. Now, listen. At what point is there a normal cognitive decline anyway? Do you feel like you'll be able to keep your mental acuity all the way to your deathbed? Or is there some natural amount of degradation that we as humans will experience?
I believe most certainly there is that degradation. I think you cannot get around that. Let's face it. Why would the brain be the exception? Your teeth, your leg muscles.
Right. Everything else is declining.
Everything else declines. So I'm fairly certain of that. What you want to do is minimize it. And again, Alzheimer's disease really is diagnosed by your level of functioning. I hope on my last 6 months of life, I will still be able to recognize my house, my family. I will be able to do those simple things, and those are the areas where people with Alzheimer's disease have problems. And so it may be a matter of degree, but there really, I think the idea now is there is something fundamentally different about Alzheimer's disease and normal aging. You cannot just say that Alzheimer's disease is just a variant of aging. It is something else, and we're working on what that something else is. Now, Heather Snyder, who was Director of Medical and Scientific Operations for the Alzheimer's Association, says this study doesn't mean that everybody should delay retirement. She says you need to stay cognitively active. I understand that, and they're absolutely right. That does help lower your risk of Alzheimer's disease. But this study stands and says what it says.
Right.
They did not look at people who stayed cognitively active in this study. So, yes, physical exercise is very important. Mental exercise is very important. But there is something about the pressure of working that does very well as well.
Well, Tony, there's a lot of questions that obviously come up on this. And most of them that I'm thinking of related to me is I've always thought I would retire not at at a relatively young age. I think in our society you can start pulling money down without tax implications at 59. You can start drawing actual government retirements at 62, and maybe by the time, it might be a little longer, But, I'd always thought maybe there might be some type of a step-down process where you get out of the extreme stress job or the high-tech job and you move into the fishing boat captain or the shrimp boat captain or whatever. I'm not saying, suggesting they don't have stressful lives. I'm kind of joking a little bit. But I do think that there are less stressful jobs that we all kind of joke about and talk about in the high-stress positions. And I've always said it many times, there's days where I just want to be a greeter somewhere.
Right.
I just want to say, hi, how you doing? Welcome.
All right, this is a great topic to talk about, and let's just stop for a minute and let's lay this out. I think, personally, I believe that as you get older, for a lot of us, it's not necessarily about the money. There's a TV commercial. You may remember, it's been a few months since it's run, but people carry around a number.
Right, IMG.
Down to
it's
the
IMG.
Last dollar and last
What's
cent.
What's your number?
And it is the most absurd commercial. My son, who's an actuary in Atlanta and actually specializes in pension and retirement, hates that commercial.
Well, yeah, but he looks at everybody's numbers as their two-digit numbers and how old they're going to be.
Well, the way he looks at it, though, there is not a number. He says for rich people, there may be a number because there's going to be so much padding in that number. But what happens if you decide to eat out tonight? You change your number? Or more importantly, if you fall and break your hip, you change your number.
Absolutely.
If you have to be in the hospital and have bypass surgery, you change your number. You cannot set a number as if you knew exactly how the rest of your life would play out.
Right.
So, frankly, if you're looking for a number, a gazillion billion, which is what the misinformed guy says, is actually a better number than $6,218,475.13, which makes no sense at all. No one can calculate those numbers, not even my son, the actuary. Now, on the flip side of it, what you said I think is important. I have advised some people. I'm starting to become old enough that I'm doing this old man advice stuff. I'm now a grandfather. You're well aware of that.
Right.
And I advise people, as you get older, you want to look at the parts of your job or the things in your life that you think are fun and start eliminating the non-fun ones and focus on the fun ones. You can afford to drop some salary as you get older because you would have retired anyway.
To remove some stress.
And then by the time you reach what would have been retirement age, you're doing stuff you find fun, and hopefully that fun will allow you to work longer. Because people don't work at non-fun jobs longer unless
right.
they have to. They have to have health benefits, and that's not really healthy. But the people who do fun things, you mentioned fishing, charter fishing, boat captains, orchestra conductors, people who work with charities, people who enjoy
well, sure.
the work they do, craftsmen, they will many times work much longer than those people who are involved in a job they don't enjoy. So the challenge then is not to say, I've got to save up a certain number of dollars and cents and then retire. The challenge is, how can I get to a job that I really enjoy and still be able to make a little bit of money and stimulate my mind? I think that's a challenge.
And more importantly, as part of the initial discussion, how do I do that and keep my cognitive brain function in a state to where I'm exercising it at the same degrees that I would have with my high stress, high thought job? How do I step down and start to do those more fun things? Do I use something, and I hate to throw, I think something like a Lumosity.com where all I'm doing is mental gymnastics? Do I do more puzzles? More,
right.
You know?
I think first of all,
we don't.
Yeah, the Alzheimer's Association actually has some suggestions. They say one is to stay active, stay physically active, because exercise, it turns out, to be a very good way to ward off dementia, lower your risk of dementia, perhaps as good as the mental cognitive exercises that Rick was talking about. Secondly, stay connected. We've talked about this again and again and again. Join a club, travel, volunteer, join the church choir. Social ties boost brain health.
Well, and it's more than just the social ties. It's not only be in that social group, but get involved in the activities they're doing so that you can help plan, prepare. And those are the things that keep your mind working.
Right. The other thing, take care of your heart by eating right, eating lots of vegetables and fruits that may protect your brain cells. It turns out, whatever you do that's good for your heart, is good for your brain. So if you can keep your blood pressure and your cholesterol down, that is very good for your brain. And then finally, the last piece of advice from the Alzheimer's Association, exactly what Rick said, do mentally challenging activities such as word puzzles and other things that stimulate thinking skills.
Would you classify listening to this show as one of those?
No. Heavens, no. I'm
really?
Sorry. Yeah, we can tell you what to do, but you're going to have to get out and actually stimulate your brain because this show, let's face it, you're only going to get
up to our IQ level. Yeah, but if you're keeping count of all the times we mess up.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, criticizing the show, where do you start? How bad is it? That will be a very useful mental exercise. But if you just sit there and listen to what we're saying, oh, heaven help you.
Now tell me that wouldn't be a stressful job. Wouldn't that? I mean, that would just be stressful. I mean, can you imagine having part of your mental acuity is to listen to 100 shows in 1 month?
Pah, that right there. If you don't have Alzheimer's when you finish, you weren't listening. All right, so time we got left, I want to go over the Alzheimer's Association 10 warning signs.
10. That means you've got like 20 seconds
each. That was their job, but 10 warning signs. One, memory changes that disrupt daily life. You can't remember the plot of your favorite TV show. You can't remember how to get out of your own neighborhood, or you can't remember the way home that you've driven many times. Dropping a name, that doesn't disrupt daily life.
Or a phone number?
Yeah, that doesn't disrupt. Well, it does a little bit, but that's not what they're talking about. Two, challenges in planning or solving problems. My father-in-law, they found out he had Alzheimer's disease when he could not set up a folding table. Simple thing like that. That was their first concrete sign. Three, difficulty completing familiar tasks at home, at work, or leisure. Again, the folding table. Four, confusion with time or place. I just cannot figure out where I am. Don't know what time it is. Five, trouble understanding visual images and spatial relationships. This is a famous one. You know, they actually have people draw a clock face to test their mental functioning. Six, new problems with words or speaking or writing. We, all the time, my wife and I, we use the wrong word. We misplace words. Radio fans, I'm sure, have heard me say the wrong word time and time again. That's not a new problem. A new problem would be if I can't actually express my thoughts at all. See, there's a new problem right there.
Right.
See what I'm saying? Seven, misplacing things, losing the ability to retrace your steps. I forgot where it was, and I forgot where I was. Eight, decreased or poor judgment. This involves home shopping network, gambling, bingo, things like that. All of a sudden, we're giving away money to strangers when we shouldn't be. Nine, withdrawal from work or social activities. Just simply too complicated to be with my friends anymore. And 10, changes in mood or personality. Those are the 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's. And again, these are things that have not been seen before, first time ever. If that's the case, get your loved one and have them evaluated. Rick, can you get us out of here?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Asa Hosoda and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook. Just look for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters extended release radio shows are approved for the treatment of moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease. Health Matters is available by prescription only.
The most common side effects associated with Health Matters treatment are headache, diarrhea, and dizziness. This is not a complete list of side effects.
10% of listeners quit listening to our show due to the side effects.
Before starting Health Matters, talk to your healthcare provider about all your past and present medical conditions, including
seizure disorders,
difficulty passing urine,
liver or kidney problems.
If the patient is taking other medications, including those without a prescription, ask your healthcare provider if Health Matters is right for the patient.
Certain medications, changes in diet, or medical conditions may affect the amount of health matters in the body and possibly increase side effects.
Whatever you do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.